guess what Jordan Davis' favorite song was. Anyway. His mom just won congressional. Primary. Lucien Bass. And thank you, Brothers Johnson. We got music to die for here. 104.1 FM, Berkeley Liberation Radio. Meetings first and third Thursdays, 3124 Shattuck, 7:30 p.m. at Long Hall.
What the message that I'm getting from you is that there is significant information contained within WikiLeaks about every country on this planet, not just about the great Western powers.
Yes. This trip through Media Stan is about the Stan countries, Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan, Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan, and finally Afghanistan. And it explains something about the role that they're playing in relation to the war in Afghanistan. Now, regarding Rwanda, Uganda, and the DRC being the Democratic Republic of the Congo, I haven't read all these yet. I was focusing particularly on Rwanda, where I've searched WikiLeaks before and quoted what I found in my work. Today, the most interesting thing that I found was a cable on the ethnic, let's see what they called it, the ethnic composition of Rwanda as it is now. And this openly admitted that it is a Tutsi aristocracy. Rwanda presents to the world as though it has overcome the division between Hutu and Tutsi. You can't even say Hutu or Tutsi in Rwanda, although they have made great effort to get other countries in the world and the UN General Assembly and the UN Security Council to call the genocide in Rwanda the genocide against the Tutsi, because they're afraid to acknowledge that Hutu people were also massacred, probably far more, by Paul Kagame's, that's the president of Rwanda now, advancing army, which advanced from Uganda, invaded from Uganda in 1990.
And the Tutsi population was something like 600,000, and the aristocracy ruling Rwanda today is about 400,000, or was right after they took power. So 600,000 minus, well, 400 equals 200,000 killed. But if we say a million, then four times as many Hutus, which sounds about what you'd expect.
And there was a war going on there from 1990 to 1994. Most people know only about the Rwanda genocide, so-called, which was 100 days in 1994. And Hotel Rwanda, the movie that was seen all over the world, is one of the most effective pieces of propaganda.
But at the time, of course, there was the, I remember 1994 very well because I asked Doug Sizemore why he was funding for, or you're still were doing syndicate work or something, but it was the oil, the public line was Rwanda didn't have oil, that's why we had to sit and watch on our screens for that horrible period of time, as if we could do nothing, but in fact we couldn't intervene in our intervention because we were behind the 1990 invasion. That was George Herbert Walker Bush, son of Hitler's banker, his governor in Arkansas, where the Mena Coke Stand attendants were taking off the Hassenfuss plane to go murder socialists in Nicaragua. It was shot down by teenagers with Stinger missiles.
That ever produced. I'm going to show you something. I read a number of books about this, but the new one is Crimes in Praise of Blood, Crimes of the Rwandan Patriotic Front. that was Paul Kagame's army, Tutsi army. I have a friend in Rwanda, close friend, although I've never met her in person. I called her most every week from KPFA in 2010 when she attempted to run for president against the incumbent Paul Kagame, who seized power in 1994 at the end of the 100 days. And she had a perfect life as an expat in Holland. She had a wonderful family, a wonderful job. But she left. She left. She went back to Rwanda because she said she couldn't stand to see her people continuing to suffer as much as they did. She attempted to run against the president of Rwanda, and instead she went to prison. Eventually, she was sentenced to 15 years. The African Court of Human and People's Rights, which is the highest court created by the African Union, said that her rights, according to the Rwandan Constitution, had been violated and that she should go free. But Paul Kagame, the president of Rwanda, who is now the president of the African Union, is just ignoring the ruling of the African Union's highest court. And of course, there's no enforcement mechanism for most of the courts, except for the International Criminal Court. There's no enforcement mechanism. So what I found in WikiLeaks in 2005 was a communique about the ethnic makeup of Rwanda. And this revealed that Washington knows that this is a Tutsi aristocracy, that all of the people in power are Tutsis. You can't say Tutsi or Hutu anymore, but most people know who's a Tutsi and who's a Hutu. So all of the people in positions of power are Tutsis. There are some Hutu, but they are paired with Tutsis who have the real power. So the United States officialdom has known this for a long time, but they go along with this myth about the Rwandan development miracle, how Paul Kagame, the president, stopped the genocide and helped Rwanda raise from the ashes and overcome these ethnic divisions. And this myth is one of the things, is one of the narratives, false narratives, that is used to justify what is called humanitarian intervention. Yeah. You could have found, and if you still search the web, you'd find many, many articles saying that Syria is the next Rwanda, and we're obliged to intervene for that reason. Now that is being said about Burma. What do they call it now? Myanmar. There's an attempt to build a consensus for an intervention in Myanmar to protect the Rohingya. Now, I'm not saying that the Rohingya, or the Rohingya, however you pronounce it, are not suffering. I'm sure that that is true. And like Victoria, I don't think I ever told you her name, Victoria Ingabire, who returned to Rwanda to try to run for president and is now in prison. No one is. She said, "I never denied the Tutsi genocide. What I've said is that Hutu people were killed. They were victims of war crimes and crimes against humanity." She didn't say genocide because it's illegal to talk about Hutu genocide or double genocide in Rwanda. I would now really like to see cables between the U.S. and Australia regarding Myanmar. There have been some information that I have found where Australia is urged to intervene there. And they're urged to intervene there to demonstrate that they are a real power, a real world power. Now, I think it is very irresponsible for anyone to report, any reporters, to report about ethnic conflict in the developing world without explaining its geopolitical context. In Myanmar, there is a pipeline going from the coast on the Indian Ocean well into China. And there are environmental struggles by indigenous people all along the way. And in China, the refinery town, there are environmental struggles because they don't want one more refinery or several more refineries. The oil coming here will no doubt be coming from Iran, which also has a border on the Indian Ocean. Am I getting that right? Anyway, if they don't have a border on the Indian Ocean, they have ready access through the Strait of Hormuz. And it would be much more advantageous for them to go straight to the coast of Myanmar and from there to China. From a pipeline to China, it would be far more advantageous for their oil to go that way. Because there are some straits, I'm forgetting the name of the straits, but there are some straits in Indonesia and
Malacca.
We call it the South Asian Sea, on the way to the eastern border of China that are full of pirates and can be blockaded, very narrow passage. Now, as I've heard, there are indigenous struggles throughout Myanmar, like the ones I told you about along the pipeline route. But the only one that we hear about is the Rohingya. So once again, I'm sure that the Rohingya are suffering. But I think it is irresponsible to talk about this without talking about the geopolitical context. Another case is the Democratic Republic of the Congo. This week, Democracy Now! Aired a feature about suffering in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, again in the east, which I have said is the most mineral-rich part. And they framed the story, they and their guests framed the story totally in terms of ethnic conflict without giving the geopolitical context. A friend of mine, Kambale Musavuli, who is a spokesman for Friends of the Congo, said that it was the typical pornography of violence that is used to talk about Africa. I hope they'll get better. Democracy Now! Did have Kambale on the air several years ago, and I hope that they will do that again.
And I want to, sorry to interrupt you, but I want to ask you a question. Oh, and by the way, I think the tapping with your pen is coming really loudly through your speakers. Okay. Again, we're so stuck in the Western mindset. We think about the persecution of Julian as being perpetrated by the US and the UK, with previously with Sweden's help, and now even maybe by the Ecuador itself, as the Ecuador moves closer economically and militarily to the US, or more in alignment with the US. But what we don't think about, is all of the other countries and regions in the world who have been negatively impacted, and the countries haven't been, but the regimes have been negatively impacted by WikiLeaks releases.
Interesting question.
What has been the reaction from those countries to the revelations made by WikiLeaks?
Well, let's see. I'd say there's been a little more reaction from Bill Clinton and Clinton Foundation, who are very, very involved in Rwanda. And I read several of the cables about that today. And then I read what Rwandans had written about the cables. Now, there may be Rwandan pressure on WikiLeaks, but there's more evident pressure on, there's more evident Rwandan pressure on various elements of the UN, and now, let's see, on Belgium. I might be getting this right or wrong. It's either Belgium or the Netherlands.
But it was Bill Clinton, at she mentioned, and he was our defendant in the anti-drug war class action lawsuit. Bill Clinton, Pete Wilson, and all the cops and judges that had busted us. About 50 of us. But it's time to resume it because, of course, the Hassan Fuss shoot-down was laying open the same bogus just say no hypocrisy behind the war on drugs that our class action lawsuit was aimed against Bill Clinton defendant and all. So keep the defendant Bill Clinton at Hillary and probably the person who had her as wedding guest, Donald Trump, et al. And let's get it started again, except that it was handed to the biggest narco-terrorist on the bench, D. Lowell Jensen, who called a short notice of hearing and didn't tell anybody. And then because, like, only one person showed up, or two of us only. D. Lowell Jensen called Leon Kellner after that Hassan Fuss shootdown to quash the Southern Air investigation because the plane was identified by the Drug Enforcement Administration as a drug-running plane. And there he was pointing to Luis Posada Carriles and Felix Rodriguez, the guy that Milian Rodriguez said shook him down for $10 million. He was a Medellin cartel laundry guy that George Bush dragged out and embarrassed, so, you know, the payback was, okay, I'll talk to Congress, I got nothing to lose, I'm already doing life. So Medellin was where Zapata Oil had one of its couple of offices in Medellin. Poppy Bush, big surprise, and of course the Afghan opium war, guess what? So anyway, any WikiLeaks cables about the 90s anti Bill Clinton anti-drug war class action lawsuit, Julian? Never mind. Back to Hank Garrison's part in the Unity for Julian 50-hour marathon. I woke up in the middle of John Kiriakou, so I didn't really appreciate what good scoop he would have on all this, so I have to go back and... But was it the first weekend of every month? There's a 50-hour... worldwide online vigil for Julian And here's some more.
Where there are many Rwandan refugees. Pressure on them to pass some kind of legislation that describes the Rwandan genocide as the genocide against the Tutsi. What is revealed in WikiLeaks about Rwanda is not flattering to the Rwandan regime or Bill Clinton or the Clinton Foundation. Now, there's something else about those Rwandan leaks that I found today. I had previously cherry-picked, as Julian said we should not do. I started reading them all, and I read quite a few from 1978. And what they revealed was Rwanda in the Cold War. The United States, now, did I tell you this? I think I told you this. Rwanda was very concerned about Rwanda's relationship with the DRC, the People's Republic of China, and Libya. Yeah, that was in 1978. That government, the Habyarimana government, was overthrown with the help of the United States. President Paul Kagame seized power, and the United States has supported him ever since and promoted this totally false idea of reconciliation, because this other cable I read said they know that all of the Tutsis, all of the top administrative posts are held by Tutsis. And they said this creates a very unstable situation. Many people have said that the Rwanda is like a powder keg. This can only go on for so long. There are 99% of the people in prison are Hutus. Many of them are in prison for practicing genocide ideology, which can mean anything from having a different narrative about the Rwandan genocide to disagreeing with the president. All of the officers, most of the officers in the army are Tutsi. Most of the foot soldiers are Hutu. Now there's an insurgency, and I talked to someone who is commonly a source for me, and he told me that he takes the insurgency seriously. That's been the question. Is this serious? He said also that if the insurgency is successful, then President Kagame will become like Charles Taylor, who was supported by the U.S. until he was defeated by an insurgency, and then they dragged him to the ICC. Now, the WikiLeaks cable, the one that I focused on most today, said that the United States understood this ethnic aristocracy, the Tutsi ruling over the Hutu, which was the situation for many years. It was a feudal situation in which the Tutsi aristocracy ruled over the Hutu. So they knew it was an unstable situation. They knew it was not the situation that they were representing to the world, which was that President Paul Kagame had ended the genocide and then raised Rwanda from the ashes and ended the ethnic division, that he had instituted reconciliation between Hutu and Tutsi. Not the case, and the United States knows that this is unstable.
And I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry to interrupt you, fading to interview you, because the things that you're talking about, the subject matter that you're covering, is something that has not been represented at all previously, either within this movement or really in any mainstream or a major alternative press that I've seen. So I need to go and do a lot more reading about your work, because I think it's extremely important that there are people like yourself who are going through the WikiLeaks cables, who are studying WikiLeaks files that relate to these other countries. And the main message that I've gotten so far out of listening to you speak is the understanding of how ignorant we are about any other region outside really of the Western world, and how much is obviously going on there. And it seems that WikiLeaks may be one of the few organizations that has been supplying massive amounts of credible information to people in those, you know, people on the ground in the region, but also to researchers like yourself. I mean, is that a fair call?
Yes.
It sounds like they've been an invaluable resource for you. So in the context that Julian is now being openly persecuted, openly tortured, openly pressured and silenced by the great powers of the world, how do you feel about that? And, you know, that we risk potentially losing Julian and WikiLeaks and this important contribution to human understanding.
I think it's horrible. Absolutely horrible. I think, as many people on this web stream have said, that we have to organize in any way we can. It's daunting because people organized and demonstrated all over the world to try to stop the Iraq war, and they failed. Oh, you know, George Gitois, who is an Australian multimedia artist, he told me, look, Julian Assange is a genius, and he may think of ways to get out of this that none of the rest of us will think of. Now, I hope he's right. And there's one other thing I wanted to say about Julian. He is a genius. And he could have been Mark Zuckerberg. He could have been a founder of some tech giant like Intel. He could have owned his own tropical island, his own yacht, his own, what do you call those things? The cruise ship. He could have been one of the wealthiest men in the world. And he chose instead to share this with us, this invaluable information with us, not only in WikiLeaks, but also about what we need to understand about what advancing technology can mean for our privacy and for information control.
You're absolutely spot on.
Julian
came up in technology at a crucial moment when the world's first internet service providers were being created. Indeed, Julian actually did have an internet service provider at a certain point.
Okay, everyone,
was described by a very accomplished hacker at the beginning of this vigil as being the greatest hacker that person had known, dating back 30 years, in terms of his understanding and his competencies, his capabilities. He absolutely could have been a tech millionaire 1,000 times over. In New Zealand, just the most basic mid-level software development manager is earning $250,000 a year. Julian could be earning millions of dollars a year in the commercial world if he was prepared to sell his intellect and his services to the corporates. But he was not, and instead he decided to serve humanity rather than to serve his own capitalistic interests. And that's absolutely evident in not only in his work, but also in his self-sacrifice and in the situation that he is now in. And I agree that we all owe him a massive debt of gratitude for that. Are there any final words that you have for Julian?
Yeah, there's something I left out, which is that Rwanda and Uganda invaded the Democratic Republic of the Congo in 1996, and then again in 1998, and they, particularly Rwanda, have been occupying forces since. And I'm going to search for information about that in WikiLeaks, although, of course, as he urged, I'm going to read everything, not just what I cherry pick. And I wish now that there were WikiLeaks available about the communications that the U.S. government is having with the governments of the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Rwanda, Uganda, and Burundi. And I know that they've been mounting a propaganda campaign to overthrow the president of Burundi because he has turned towards the east. He signed a major mining contract, the major mining contract in Burundi with a Russian firm. And he has become close to China.
Which means you can guarantee that further conflict will follow one way or another. And time and time again, we have seen WikiLeaks cable change outcomes for countries, change the course of the Iraq war when it forced withdrawals, and in Afghanistan also. And in Kenya, we know it was that WikiLeaks releases were extremely significant in changing the outcome of a Kenyan election. So I think we can't even begin to imagine a world without WikiLeaks, and I hope that we never have to do that. And thank you so much for being on the stream. I greatly appreciate it.
Thank you for inviting me.
And thank you for making this public stand for Julian and for WikiLeaks.
Well, I don't think of
that the money is the root of all evil. I forget who said that, you know, but it happens to be true. And what we have now is a lot more than what President Eisenhower, talked about. He talked about the military-industrial complex. Now we have the military-industrial, congressional, intelligence, media complex. Media is the biggie. Why do I say media? Because the same corporations that profits here on all this war making and all this tension are controlled by the media, is controlled by these same corporations. But it wasn't the Intelligence Committee, it wasn't 17 agents, it wasn't three agents, it was handpicked analysts, right, that came to these broad conclusions about how WikiLeaks got this information from Russians and then tried to destroy Hillary, okay? That's the legend. WikiLeaks got a very meaningful left-hand compliment, as we say in the States, from these same analysts, because someone asked them, why did they choose WikiLeaks to do this? And the analyst said, because WikiLeaks has a very clean record of not distorting anything or embroidering anything. On their, you know, everybody believes that, you know, their record is clean. Say, holy Moses, you know. What a neat little compliment from these unconscionable charlatans, really, who are trying to advance their careers by bending to the prevailing winds at the upper reaches of their agency. So that's kind of an amusing detail, but it's very relevant, and I think it's very telling that they gave this left-handed compliment to WikiLeaks expressly because WikiLeaks has never been caught in adulterating any of the documentary evidence they put out. And, you know, as a former intelligence analyst, just like detectives or investigative reporters, documentary evidence is what we lust after. I mean, we lust after this kind of evidence because it's the best available. And it's too bad that that disgruntled person within the Democratic National Committee copied all those emails from Hillary and from the DNC and then gave that thumb drive to Julian. But, you know, it's It's Hillary's own damn fault. They're not embroidered. They're not falsified. That's what she did. You know, and when I think, you know, just the last thing I'll say, when I think that we could have Bernie Sanders instead of that clown that we've got as president right now. My God! And whose fault is that? It's Hillary Clinton's fault.
Well, black box selective processes shouldn't be giving agency to blah, 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 blah.
Now, as you know, we have been engaged in the United States in a massive struggle to make desegregation and finally integration a reality. And in that struggle, there has been an undergirding philosophy. The philosophy of nonviolence, the philosophy and method of nonviolent resistance. And I'd like to say just a few words about the method or the philosophy that has undergirded our struggle. First, I want to say that I'm still convinced that nonviolence is the most potent weapon available to oppressed people in their struggle for freedom and justice. It has a way of disarming the opponent, exposing his moral defenses. It weakens his morale, and at the same time, it works on his conscience, and he just doesn't know how to handle it. If he doesn't beat you, wonderful. If he beats you, you develop the quiet courage of accepting blows without retaliating. If he doesn't put you in jail, wonderful. Nobody with any sense loves to go to jail, but if he puts you in jail, you go in that jail and transform it from a dungeon of shame to a haven of freedom and human dignity. Even if he tries to kill you, you develop the inner conviction that there are some things so dear, some things so precious, some things so eternally true that they are worth dying for. And if a man has not discovered something that he will die for, he isn't fit to live.
Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue to look back at last year's deadly white supremacist rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, at the rally, a neo-Nazi named James Alex Fields drove his Dodge Charger into a crowd of counter-demonstrators, killing 32-year-old anti-racist activist Heather Heyer. 19 other people were injured. Fields has since been charged with first-degree murder as well as federal hate crimes. We're now joined by Heather's mother, Susan Breaux. She joins us from Charlottesville and joins A.C. Thompson as well, who did the documentary premiering tonight on PBS Frontline. Susan, it's a year later, but it's my first time to offer you my condolences, the whole family at Democracy Now!'s condolences on the death of your daughter, Heather.
Thank you so much.
So it has been a year since August 12th when you lost your daughter.
Heather always believed and acted on her beliefs that equality was for all people, that if anybody is marginalized in the human race, then we all are. So when her friends who were African American were going to be at the rally, they said, come with us. And at first she was like, nah, I think I'll stay away. And then she saw where her friend Courtney had live streamed the events of Friday night. And she said, I have to go. And her friend tried to talk her out of it. And she said, I know it's dangerous. I could die, but I have to be there. And of course, when we say things like that, we don't really think we're going to die. But she was there to support her friends. And the group that she was with deliberately stayed away from the fighting all day. Wherever they saw fights, they turned away. And she was with a very large group of counter-protesters. She personally didn't even carry any signs. She just had her cigarettes, her lighter, her keys, and her phone with her. She had parked her car nearby. And she was dressed to go to work as a waitress later. She had her hair back in a long braid, and she had on her black shirt and black top that she would wear to waitress. And she thought it was going to be just a day of walking the streets. You know, shouting Black Lives Matter and whose streets, our streets. And they had done that all day long. From what I understand from Marcus and Marissa, her friends, they thought the Nazis were all leaving. Everybody was kind of relaxed and happy as they were coming back onto the barricaded mall, and they were going to get some food and some water. It was a really hot day, and that's when Mr. Fields chose to drive his car into the crowd.
And he
did.
Injured.
Yes.
I just recently saw pictures of the wedding you were at of her dear friends, made famous because her friend, his feet up in the air as he was just upended by this car.
Now his leg was shattered.
As he was pushing his partner away from the car, trying to save her life.
Right. He told me he reached for Heather. He couldn't get to her, but he at least knocked Marissa out of the way. And I said, honey, it's okay. And he still cries about that to this day. He's so frustrated and angry about that. It is what it is, and we move forward. You know, I can't be consumed by grief to where I can't function. I have to move forward. So my life now revolves around, not only have I picked up Heather's baton and I'm running with it, but I'm also passing it off to as many people as I possibly can. They tried to silence my daughter, one voice. You don't get to do that. I said at her funeral, you just magnified her, because not only am I going to speak up and speak louder, but I'm going to make sure lots of other people speak up too. We're leaving, a girl in a black helmet, and she said, talk to me about why you're here. Why do you feel this way? What made you want to come? Why do you hate people? Can you talk to me about it? Can you explain to me? And, you know, tried to be gently pulling the girl out of her belief system to talk to her. All the girl would say to her was, no comment, no comment. Because that's what they're trained to do. But that was Heather's method of converting people, was talking one-on-one.
Outraged, you're not paying attention.
Yes. One press article mistakenly put that she did that to help the poor, and somebody told me they got that from the website. We'll get that changed. Not only poor people file for bankruptcy. Donald Trump has filed for bankruptcy many times. I don't think he actually came to Heather for help, but a lot of people file for bankruptcy, but she was the bankruptcy intake person. She handled every single file that came through the office. And after she died, thousands of people over the course of the last year have come to me and said, well, I knew Heather. And I say, how did you know her? And sometimes they'll say they knew her as a bartender or a waitress, but sometimes, more often than not, they'll say they met her at Miller Law Group, and that she was a person who made them feel comfortable, at ease. Many times she would help people figure out how they didn't have to even file for bankruptcy, so they never actually became a client, because Heather could help them figure out what they needed to do to save their car, save their house, and get themselves back on track.